beat the National League 8-6 in 10 innings. Northwoods League Baseball last night, the Kenosha Kingfish shut out by the Green Bay Bullfrogs 1-0. Those two teams meet again tonight, 7:05, once again at Simmons Field. Now the WGTD Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny and pleasant, today's high 78. 58 overnight, 83 degrees tomorrow. Right now, wind is calm, humidity 80%, 65 degrees in Racine, 69 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. One of the most fascinating and groundbreaking documentary films of all time was a film made in 1975 by Albert and David Maisels, titled Grey Gardens. It was an intimate, unvarnished look at the lives of two eccentric women, Edith Beale and her daughter Edie Beale, once wealthy women who were by that point living in squalor and isolation in a rapidly deteriorating mansion in East Hampton, New York, that had once been magnificent. What made their story all the more remarkable was that the two women were the aunt and cousin, respectively, of Jacqueline Kennedy. Now we can revisit the story of Grey Gardens and the story of Edith and Edie Beale through the eyes of Jerry Torrey, who, as a young teenager, actually lived with and worked for the Beals at the time that the Grey Gardens film was made. His own story, including the story of how he stumbled quite by accident into the lives of the Beals and became an important part of that eccentric household, is told in a newly published memoir titled The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens, a memoir of the Beals, the Maisels brothers, and Jacqueline Kennedy, published by Corel Press. Jerry Torrey's co-author is film historian Tony Maietta. Tony Maietta, I wonder if you could say a quick word about your own career as a film historian and how that, in a sense, ushered you into the story of Jerry Torrey and made possible the collaboration on this book.
Certainly. It's great to be here, Greg. Nice to talk with you. Well, basically, you know, I began my career as an actor. I always loved Hollywood of the 30s and 40s and 50s, and I thought that I would find it when I moved there in the 90s. Fortunately, it doesn't exist anymore, so I kind of reset my focuses on kind of going to that part of that glorious part of Hollywood in my writing. And I've done work with Turner Classic Movies. I've done work with CBS Home Video primarily on The Lucy Show and I Love Lucy, the DVDs and the Blu-rays. And I've written articles here and there. I've been fascinated with Grey Gardens since I first saw the film, and I think that was probably back in 2001. And it's just something that I feel that once I saw, I could not get out of my mind. Edie Beale and her mother, Edith Bouvier Beale, are just two characters that just grasp you and just captured my imagination. So I've always been fascinated with Grey Gardens. I've written about it before in articles and on the internet. And when I had the opportunity, I was working on a project about the Maisel brothers, and I met Jerry quite accidentally. He was at a screening of Grey Gardens with Al Maisels, and I had no idea that as many people did, and I've said this before, there are so many untruths about Jerry out there, you know, that he's dead, that he's not around. And I was like, oh, my God, it's Jerry. This is Jerry. And I met Jerry and found him absolutely as captivating and as sincere and just as wonderful as I hoped he would be. And I thought, we have to work together. He started telling me his story, and I thought, this is something that you need to put down, Jerry. We need to work on this, and we need to get your story out there because it's every bit as compelling as the story of the Beatles. And his life is just something I think that needed to be shared, and I was so honored that he allowed me to share that with him.
Jerry, could you say a word about the experience of collaborating with Tony Maeda on writing your own story? I have a feeling that it probably came as a tremendous surprise to you that someone would be so interested and so insistent that your own story would be worthy of this kind of attention.
Thank you for asking that question. Good morning, Craig, and good morning, Tony. I met Tony at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for the screening of Mrs. Beale's film, Grey Gardens, the 80s film, the documentary. And before that, I had tried to work with authors, so to say, on this book, but they actually teetered out and they weren't serious. They were not committed. Tony was the first person, the first man that I really felt the gravity to complete a project, and this was the idea, this project. It's Tony's, his instrumental in asserting himself to get this completely done. Mind you, it's a lot of work. And he, his fortitude and persevered, and with his professionalism, is reason why this book is completed. I am honored, and I have been honored since I met Tony. And again, he's so instrumental in helping with the book, of course. The book is always something I wanted to do. And Mrs. Beale, years ago, and just between one difficult moment and another, said to me, that in our lives, in your life, our friendship is going to be of interest to many people. I didn't quite understand what that meant then. Of course, Mrs. Beale was an elderly woman, had more wisdom and experience. But it meant more to me to help and protect them rather than anything else. There was no money involved in our friendship. There was basically a concern for each other. And so I wanted very much the public to know this and maybe learn a little bit about struggles in life that can be overcome. And perhaps someone who would read the book would understand that there's other ways of living and respecting each other. I know that's a broad stroke, but that was my hope, and fortunately it has occurred.
Hmm. Well, it's a terrific book, and I just love the way it's put together. And I love the way that it opens. Tony, I would love to have you explain the interesting prologue of this book in which we learn of the most remarkable of coincidences that, in a sense, helps bring Jerry back into the central focus of the story of Grey Gardens after many, many years.
Thanks. Yeah, I love that prologue, too. I think when Jerry first told me that story, I thought, I mean, there was never a question, this is how the book opens. Because I think it's just indicative of how Jerry's life has unfolded. Jerry is somebody who has always, from the time he was 16 years old and first approached the mansion, is someone who has put himself out. If simply, you know, by knocking on the door of Grey Gardens that first time, by talking with this woman in the back of his cab. I mean, just because he is a person who loves people and wants to reach out to people. And I thought, this is why you've had the life that you've had, because you are open to talking to people with a great deal of love and compassion. And because, I mean, there are no accidents. I mean, there just aren't. There's a reason. Jerry and I have always felt that this project was guided by a higher force, and I think that's Jerry's life. You know, I think that there was not an accident that he happened to pick up this fare that night. In this particular time in his life when he was coming to terms with, you know, he was coming to terms with his life, basically. He'd been through tremendous difficulties, and he came through and he survived them. So he was at a point in his life where he was ready, if you will, to return home, kind of like the prodigal son. So he picks up a fare on 9th Avenue in Manhattan and just begins a conversation with him, with her, and finds out that she is a friend of Albert Maisel's and that Albert Maisel's has been trying to get in touch with him for years, you know, about Grey Gardens. So it's just a kind of synchronicity, if you will, that I think Jerry's life has been full of. And I think the prologue to the book, this particular episode, is just kind of indicative of that kind of spirit that embodies Jerry and has embodied his life.
Right. So we're talking about a very much chance encounter that occurs in 2005, and so a couple of decades had gone by since there had been any contact with either of the Maisel brothers, and by this point, one of them had sadly passed away, but Albert, who wrote the introduction to this book, was still around and so thrilled to reconnect with Jerry. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jerry Torrey and Tony Maietta about the book The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens. This is the memoir of Jerry Torrey, who was on the scene meeting and befriending the Beals, Edith and her daughter, and those two remarkable women and the decaying mansion in which they lived were captured in this remarkable documentary film called Grey Gardens, and a sequel as well. And we are now hearing the story of Jerry Torrey, who is seen in that film and who knew the Beals and lived and worked in this incredible home. Jerry Torrey, you talk in your book about some of the pain that was a part of your childhood, particularly the pain inflicted by your abusive father. Tell our listeners a little bit more about that pain and what it was like to revisit it in writing this memoir. To any extent, was writing about these painful experiences, in a sense, therapeutic for you?
Indeed it was. Thank you for asking. The childhood, the non-existent childhood that I had, was so very brief, and it was confusing. I didn't know exactly what was wrong or how I had been introduced to such a cruel start. My father was a very good provider, but he was very stubborn and heavy-handed. So everything went his way, or you got a beating. Period. And that happened a little bit too often. And I grew up and finally, in my teens, decided I no longer could tolerate, you know, his strict European values. And mind you, maybe they weren't just European, but he was very heavy-handed. So, well, that was the way it went. And I ran. I ran away from home. I had a very abusive childhood insofar as I had been sexually abused as a boy as well. So I had no choice but to leave or maybe even not survive. It was therapeutic writing this book, Greg, because it flushes out for me to remember and to let go of the past. And writing it down and sharing it with those who may be abusing their child, and let's be candid, or maybe those who are abusing someone or a person in trouble with this issue, maybe they can see how wrong it is and that it does affect people and it ruins lives. Confusion. Perhaps they will say to themselves, you know, if Jerry can overcome that turmoil, perhaps I can, and so on and so on. Therapeutic in the sense that I can at least try to help. It was the reason I ran away from home, and it was only through the grace of God that it was just an amazing adventure. I find a job on Lily Pond Lane. Should I go on to tell you this?
Absolutely. Although I do want to mention that in some ways, you know, you suffered all kinds of indignity and abuse at the hands of your father, and also some sexual abuse at the hands of an older boy in the neighborhood. But if I remember correctly, in a sense, kind of the last straw, which is what really prompted you to finally leave home, was something involving your admittance to kind of an early admissions program to SUNY and college. And what your father did was something that was just like the last straw. Explain what he did.
Well, excuse me, I have a little bit of laryngitis. Well, what happened, I had applied for a scholarship at Cobleskill Agricultural College, upstate New York. I was fascinated, still am, in nature, and decided I'd focus on one realm, one avenue, and that was animal husbandry. I had hoped to one day be a veterinarian because nature was my calling, and I knew that would be a good profession to be a vet. So I applied, and I was accepted into Cobleskill Agricultural Facility College for animal husbandry. And I tried to pay my way into the college. I attempted 2 months here in New York City at SUNY. They couldn't simply hold a $61 a week job and pay tuition and survive. So I could not go. But when I was approved for the scholarship, my father and mother drove me up to the country, and we looked at the campus, but he wasn't going to foot the bill, for lack of a better term, for my education. And I really was aggravated with that because I was just chomping at the bit to be taught something substantial and to learn a career. And to have that turned down, like just hands down no, without a reason why, I just decided and knew then that I'd have to strike out and do it on my own. Again, I did try, like I said earlier, at the SUNY colleges here in New York City, but couldn't afford it. So that was it. When that happened, I said, you know, you really are on your own with anything you choose to do. You're going to have to do it from scratch. And therefore, I did. I had no way to go, so I went my own way.
Hmm. So you end up finding a job as a part-time gardener on an estate in East Hampton, earning $100 a week and also free room and board. And this was going to be a way for you to build for yourself a brand new life. One of the most interesting things you describe about that job at that estate of Gerald Geddes is what you describe as an absolute law on that estate in terms of the work you did in relation to the Geddes family and their guests and so on. Explain what I'm talking about. What was that absolute law that you could absolutely never violate?
Well, the first day that it was mentioned to me, the rule of the house was preposterous. I was told by Mr. Geddes I was not to be seen on the property. Mind you, he has at least 6 acres of lawn and an oceanfront view. The property means, well, I was an assistant gardener, so I turned to Mr. Geddes, with all due respect, sir, I am the gardener assistant. How am I to cut the lawn and not be seen? And he said to me that would be my problem. He didn't want me to be seen on the property. In other words, lifting up a branch that may have fallen or trimming a hedge or something. I mean, I didn't have an idea of how to hide from view when he drove into the driveway, his chauffeur would drive him. And a few occasions he fired me because I was seen on the lawn, on the riding lawnmower. And he would roll up the window and, you're fired. And I was a kid. I was all kinds of hysterical, lost a really good job. But it was preposterous how not to be seen on a palatial estate, a lawn where you could see a bird landing on the other end of the driveway. So that was perplexing and stupid. But it did happen, and he was a power-crazy person. And he absolutely loved, well, I think he actually enjoyed controlling his crew, his household staff, to this degree of cruelty. It was really the way he was. I didn't deal with him but that time, and then once again. But the rule of law was I had not to be seen. So I devised a little plan, and, well, in the middle of the lawn was a beech tree, and the driveway swept around and behind it. So when the chauffeur would enter of the driveway and the gravel from the tires rolling over the blue chip gravel, you could hear them. I would just then quickly descend and underneath the branches of that beech tree on the riding lawnmower and blend in and be hidden by the sweeping branches. This comedy went on for some time. And I didn't get fired but 2 times, and I did regain my job, which was $100 a week and room and board. Mind you, Greg, Tony, this was an opportunity for I run away from Brooklyn. I had the ocean, refrigerators full of food, and a beautiful home to live in, a uniform, and all I had to do was what became natural to me, and that was clean up on the lawn and keep leaves out of the pool. It was a charming job, and I loved working in the country.
And you also say that you said tending to the plants of the vast gardens and encountering wildlife had a healing effect on your soul. I mean, we have to remember the really intensely unhappy childhood that you'd experienced up until then. And this was like being in paradise to have an experience like this. And are able to sequester a bit of your extra money, are able to purchase a 10-speed bicycle, and it is on one of those bike rides through East Hampton that you first caught sight of the roof, largely hidden by trees, of an intriguing house, and you went exploring. And needless to say, the house in question was this place that had been nicknamed Gray Gardens. Somebody should explain the nickname Gray Gardens, why this mansion bore that nickname. I never knew that until reading your book.
It was because Jerry, and correct, because I don't have the horticultural bent that Jerry does, so I'll get the name of the species of the flowers wrong, but it's because a certain flower could not bloom there. Isn't that correct, Jerry? What was that?
Yes.
Why it was called Gray Garden?
The delphinium
would not. What would happen with the delphinium? I can't remember exactly. Is it because it wouldn't bloom? It stayed gray.
Well, it's excuse me. The delphinium is a beautiful plant, but it needs sweet soil, not acid soil or salt water air. What happens when they begin to bloom, and they do very well the first propagation and beginning of to bloom and grow, but once they reach a certain height and a good morning dew comes across the ocean, the salt water in that dew will burn the flower, and they dry back, and they turn gray. Yeah. And for years attempting to grow delphinium, the plant would dry back a gray tone, and Duffer, the name Gray Gardens came from that particular species.
Yeah, it was given by a previous gardener to the estate. And so it's kind of, as we point out in the book, it's kind of ironic and foreshadowing. I mean, they had no idea when they nicknamed the place Gray Gardens how true that nickname would be. You know,
right. And in some ways, it's an absolutely ideal name for that mansion and the women living there and the state of their lives and so on. It's fascinating. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jerry Torrey and Tony Maeda, who are the co-authors of a memoir called The Marble Faun of Gray Gardens, a memoirs of the Beals, the Maysles brothers, and Jacqueline Kennedy. And Jerry Torrey was, for a number of years, living with the Beals, Edith and Edie Beal, and their lives, their intriguing lives, were captured in the remarkable documentary Gray Gardens. And at last, we have the story of Jerry Torrey, who was part of that experience. We have his own perspective now on this remarkable story. So, Jerry Torrey, you go exploring what is barely visible over the tops of these thick trees, and you find this dilapidated mansion with a dilapidated old Cadillac out front, and are wondering if anybody can possibly even live here. And you ultimately come face to face with the two women who, in fact, were living there. Describe to us your first time actually walking into this old mansion, what you confronted in terms of visually and the smell.
Well, it's quite candid. You can be honest. It's the truth. It did stink. It had a terrible odor. But the mansion was on a corner, and you wouldn't have known that if you didn't slow down and look for it, because it was so overgrown with vines. And the front lawn was rather bushes. It was just bushes. And more vines on top of those. And, of course, the tree on the side of the house hid that portion. But It was one day on my bicycle. I had a blue Peugeot bicycle, 10-speed, and I had ridden riding everywhere but this one country road. And then I turned left, and there was a peak of one of the rooms on the second floor of this mansion, which simply didn't make any sense. Every mansion, every estate in East Hampton is more beautiful than the next. Pristine grounds and stables and ocean. Then here was what looked like an abandoned house right in the middle of all of these beautiful properties right along the ocean. And it didn't add up, so that drew me right into curiosity mode. And I did finally muster up the courage the next day to go up to the front porch. I passed the car, and the keys were still in the ignition. And then after that, I just said, well, you're here. Walk to the porch already. And I did. And I cleared the diamond-shaped window and then looked into the vestibule. There were cobwebs draped from the banister to the chandelier to the candelabra to the piano to the living room. There was just a sea of cobwebs. Edie would travel through those. I didn't know her name then. But I stared in disbelief. It would look like a tomb, an old home, but it was in rather poor condition. And I could see the cobwebs, just dusty cobwebs hanging every which way. And then I did knock on the door, well, the window. And Edie traveled downstairs and opened had a wonderful Dutch door, screen door. And she opens the door, and the first thing that hit me was the smell of the mansion, the cats and rotting wood and wildlife. It was a presence for sure. But Edie opens the door and touches the side of my long hair and says, "Mother, the marble faun is here." And I answer back, "I don't know who that is, but if you needed any help with the property, I'm willing to help you," because I didn't know what to say. I wanted very much to be able to communicate and learn and find curiosity, satisfy my curiosity with what I was now witnessing behind the open door. There were all of these elements, the sound of cats, the darkness of a corridor, a dusty window with shaded vines hanging over it. That was the first morning. Hmm. I spoke with Edie.
You
the following morning, I was invited back, and I went to Mrs. Beale on the second floor, up the stairs to the second floor sunroom. There were cats resting on the banister, and raccoon tails hanging from the ceiling above, and cobwebs just draped everywhere and landing on the cheeks of my face, and echoes of cats in the hallways and corridors. The more I walked up the stairs, the greater my curiosity became. What does that door lead to, and where does this door lead to? It was a time stop, warped. Time had stopped in that mansion, every bit of, I suppose, 40 years. And then I turned left and a short right, and there's this elegant woman reclining in a chaise lounge with a big hat, you know, colorful floppy hat, and she looks at me, and she looks up at me and says, "You need to eat a boiled potato and a broiled piece of chicken and a green salad to maintain that beautiful face of yours." She is saying this. I didn't think that was the case for me personally, but I was so enthralled with her demeanor and her genuine carefulness and caring for me. And mind you, cats are scurrying every which way, and it's just overwhelming, and my eyes are tearing. But I decided then to vow to help because of the tenderness this woman showed to me right off the bat. I found out later I was the first person invited into the mansion in nearly 40 years, which meant a lot to me.
Right.
So that was And
of course, you write at about this point in the book, I had to find out what mysteries this house held. I mean, that was one of the things that, you know, sort of drew you to investigate. But then especially once you had met Mrs. Beale, Edith Beale, and experienced her kindness and her interest in you, then you had this genuine interest in helping them. And we should also clarify that when you offered to help them maybe clear away some of the brush that was obscuring the house and cleaning up other things, You weren't asking for any money at all. You were willing to help them absolutely for free. Can you explain what that motivation was?
Well, of course, I was a guest just to be invited inside the mansion. Honestly, did not know what to offer these women because I was a stranger. But it was charming and trusting of them to let me into their mansion. All I could think of was helping them because that's all that a person could do. There was no sense in trying to understand the situation because it was so dire. But my instinct was to help and to avoid any, well, how much you want to be paid and all this silliness. I just, of course, did volunteer and did not be paid. I was not paid ever once, $25. But
that was something that I felt,
you know.
Go ahead, Jerry. I'm sorry.
No, I wasn't there for money. I was there to help. I mean, it was very obvious that it was a dangerous situation for two women, no less. One who seemed a bit handicapped, you know. Well.
That was something that I wanted to, that was important to me in the book. One of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, because I think that Jerry, over the years, his motivations have been misconstrued. I mean, Edie doesn't help, you know, in the film when she kind of has her suspicions about Jerry and then says them to the camera, you know, which doesn't exactly help. But over the years, Jerry's been portrayed unkindly as someone who was trying to take advantage of these women, and that could not be further from the truth. I mean, he was there to help, and only to help. To him, and you know, I think you can agree with me on this, Jerry, he was there, it was a family. These were women who needed him. He was a runaway without a family, in essence, looking for a family. And so with these two women, they became the most unlikely and closest of families for a short time. And that was Jerry's motivation. It was to help and to be part of this, to return this love that he immediately felt from Mrs. Beale and Edie. And the idea that he, you know, was an opportunist is something which unfortunately has been kind of propagated through the years, and it's just I wanted to set the record straight on that specifically.
Jerry, one of the things I want to be sure to ask you about as well is that you're not only taken by kind of the mystery of, you know, what is this place and how did it get to be the way it is, and and responding to the kindness of Edith Beale, but also you said you were really taken by Mrs. Beale and Edie's fascinating joy of living that made life at Grey Garden so enthralling for this inhibited kid from Brooklyn. What exactly do you mean by their fascinating joy of living?
Well, that makes a good question. It makes it all came to, excuse me, it became very clear to me one winter night. It was brutal. The window was off the ocean. The house was icy cold. The only room that was warm enough was the center bedroom. And Mrs. Beale had requested I collect some music from the library so they could play and sing along to it. They loved singing in theater and verse literature. I did. I collected some music and put them on the little record player. And it made sense this moment. Besides the corridors being icicles, and cats scurrying all over, and the house was deplorable. And the room we were in was about the only livable room. The music began to play, and the ladies began to sing in harmony to a tune I forgot long ago. It was an opera of some kind. And it just melted my heart to see their courage and the truth of their convictions. All they sought, their zenith, was to sing and to perform and be musical and create art, and that was their calling, and it was this spirit, and I still believe, and I think Tony will agree, it was this very spirit that catapulted them from 50 years ago, a film, to the Broadway stage, a musical, mm-hmm. that their very venue was once again appreciated by many. It was this love of life and culture and art, music and so on, that was their calling. And I sat back in that chair and I looked. I didn't let Mrs. Beale see I was emotional, but I was, because they were so courageous and I was so proud of them. They were not aware of the conditions out in the corridor, and I was. And I said, how on earth could they just draw such strength from their own convictions. At the time, I was just very proud, and still am, of their mindset to live as the people they and study the things they loved. It wasn't much to ask for two people to enjoy art, and then to be ostracized for that very venue, which is ridiculous. They were, and anyway, that was the moment I realized their love for life was stronger than any of the facts around them. Their deteriorating mansion, or their health, or lack of food, and of course heat and hot water. They were very, they had it really tough, and they survived it.
And of course, you and you were willing to help them out in all kinds of different ways, not only working really hard to help tidy the place up, you were even went so far as to go to the local market and shoplift a few groceries when the supply of food went was and going way above and beyond, and again with no compensation whatsoever, except just to be able to be part of this intriguing family. I want you to briefly describe one of the most remarkable passages in the book, which is what in which you describe, Jerry, what it was like to feed all of the feral cats, dozens and dozens of feral cats that kind of had run of the mansion, and what it and what it meant when you would be called to feed them fish. Just describe this picture to our listeners. It's amazing.
Body of water, the Atlantic Ocean on one side, but the other side of long, of this area was a gardener's bay, easy to fish in. And I would go there, fish for porgies and sea robins, and collect them, but they were easy catching. I caught pails of them, and we'd bring them back to Mrs. Beale's mansion, bring them into the kitchen, put them in the pot, boil them up on the top of the stove, a little gas stove, and then carry that pail of boiled fish to the one of the bedrooms upstairs is called the boys' room. And in this room, which was very haunted, and it was definitely cluttered and filthy, there was a hole in the ceiling, and I put a writing desk under that hole in the ceiling, and then a desk, and then a stool, a sitting regular, like a bar stool, onto the desk. And then I would, this is something I really got a kick out of. It's very spooky, too. I spilled the boiled fish out onto the floor, and cats would descend. Mind you, I had people see a dozen, maybe, cats in the film, but there were another generation of very feral wild cats in the attic that would descend to the stool, to the desktop, bouncing onto the floor, and ravenous animals eating this boiled fish. And you dare not go near them because they were big as little dogs, and they were powerful. And they would just, I wish I could have filmed it, they would just jump and hop onto the floor continually from the attic above. And I'm talking 20 cats, major animals. And they got used to, well, I would do a little whistle, and they knew I was there, and then they'd come looking out the rafters and the ceiling, and sure enough, that was luncheon for the crew in the attic.
Right. You wrote, it was a thrilling and frightening spectacle to watch, the speed with which they descended from above and the moaning and growling as they devoured the food. It was a little bit like a horror movie. I just made sure that I was as far back as possible for fear of getting caught in their rampage. That's just one detail that gives us a sense of the state of affairs in this in this old mansion. Tony Maietta, I want you to explain the first time cameras came to Gray Gardens. It was not to create the documentary film that eventually was made. This was for an entirely different reason.
Explain this. Yes, it's so true. Well, it's actually kind of interesting. It's another example of how this, I feel this project is kind of guided by a force from above. The film originally, Lee Radswell, who was, of course, Jackie Kennedy's sister, therefore the cousin to Edie Beale and the niece of Mrs. Beale, wanted to film a kind of like a home movie, if you will, of her childhood in East Hampton. And she hired a friend of hers, Peter Beard, and Lee hired the Maisels to make this home movie. And that is how the Maisels first went to Gray Gardens. So that film, that home movie, which was thought lost for years, is actually now out. It's called That Summer, and people can see it. And you can see Grey Gardens before it was Grey Gardens, if you will. And so that is how cameras first entered Grey Gardens, was because Lee Radzwell wanted to document the East Hamptons and her fond memories of being a child in East Hampton. Now, there's some kind of confusion as to whether or not she knew the state, the true state of the mansion when she first went there, but she certainly was instrumental in helping getting it cleaned up. And but she shelved that film. After she saw the footage, for whatever reason, she decided, she told her friend Peter Beard, who owned the footage, she didn't want to do anything with it. So once she decided she wasn't going to do anything with the film that she made, it made the Maisels, it allowed the Maisels to then contact the Beals on their own to create their own film, because obviously their imagination was sparked by meeting these two women and being in a situation. And when Lee said she didn't want to go on with her film, the Maisels then picked up the torch and made their own film, which of course became Grey Gardens as we know it. But the original footage, which is in the film this summer, is amazing. I mean, you really see Grey Gardens before the cleanup. There were a number of raids. There were a number of cleanups. The one that Jerry and I talk about in the film was the big one that happened right before Grey Gardens was filmed.
Right, where the health department comes in and threatens to have them forcibly removed. And, of course, a frantic 10-day frenzy of cleanup occurs to stave off that action. Tony, I also want to have you say then a word about when the Maisels return to create this documentary film, which comes to be known as Grey Gardens. The motivation, especially for Edie, to allow this to occur. Explain what she envisioned this film as meaning for her personally.
Oh, it was going to be the beginning of her career. You know, she was finally going to be discovered. You know, Edie wanted to be an actress. Edie was a performer from the moment she was born. She got it from her mother. Her mother was also a performer. And Edie always felt thwarted by life, by the circumstances of life, that she was never able, in her mind, to realize her full potential as an actress, as a singer, as a dancer. She always, you know, she got very bitter with Jackie when Jackie got the notoriety before she did. So this, to Edie, this was her moment. You know, someone was finally giving her big break, and this was her opportunity to fulfill her destiny as a great singer, a great actress, a great dancer. They both wanted more singing in the film. They would be very happy if it was entirely a musical, which is kind of ironic that it became a musical. But she absolutely saw this as her opportunity to grab the spotlight, which she thought was rightfully hers, and hold it. And, you know, in a way, that's exactly what happened. It didn't happen the way she thought it would, but, you know, 40 years later, we're still talking about her, and she's been the subject of a Broadway musical, a couple films, books. I mean, it's astounding. It's astounding what happened with her.
Right. And Jerry Torrey, you described the Maisels in very positive terms. That is, these filmmaking brothers who came in and created this documentary film. You really describe them as being always very respectful, and no matter what shocking things they saw in this mansion or the kind of the shocking behavior of especially Edie, they never betrayed any of that sort of astonishment. I mean, they really treated the Beals with great affection and respect.
Yes, absolutely. Albert, God bless them. David, the brother David, they were totally respectful of Mrs. Beal and Edie, and they were just there. The machine, the recording machine, did its job. Mrs. Beal and Edie, there was no script. And Al, who you hardly did ever see because he was behind this bazooka of a cannon. It looked like a camera. It looked like an armed vehicle. And it was he was behind it all the time, just doing his artwork and letting the camera collect images. They were always polite and always respectful. Made an appointment to come by the mansion, whether or not that appointment was fulfilled or not, which sometimes Edie didn't allow it to happen that particular day, but most of the time she was receptive. They were always understanding of their privacy. They didn't egg them on. They didn't advise them. They didn't suggest to them how they should do things or how to behave. So therefore, they were very comfortable. And what you see is, frankly, exactly what they were like. Edie did, of course, perform a little bit for the cameras. Tony's right as rain. Edie was always the performer, wanting to be the actress, as she had picked that up from her mother, Mrs. Beale, who adored singing. But Albert and David were complete gentlemen. Right up to the last few days of his life, Albert was completely good friend to Edie, and I can't say enough about them. They're really very decent in their business and their film.
The most
respectful people.
Right. So, I know, Jerry, that when you first saw this film, it was upsetting to you, primarily because of some of the things that Edie was caught saying on camera about you and her suspicions of you. And it was tremendously hurtful for you to realize the kind of animosity that she seemed to actually feel towards you. What do you feel now when you revisit this film, which I know you have seen much more recently? Have you come to terms with their feelings for you and your place in their lives?
Oh, I actually had way back when, sometime after the film premiered, and I did see it for the first time, Edie would absolutely come up with information based on our own thoughts and just spill them out. And, of course, the attic and the book, who's moving books in this attic? Well, there was a trio of raccoons up there, and they tore that place apart. And I did say to Edie, you know, I saw the film, of course you were there when I saw it. I turned to Edie after the film, and I said, Edie, I didn't know that you felt uneasy with me about the books and being a, it seems to me that you're portraying me as a dishonest friend, and indeed you know me well enough. So please, let me know if you feel uncomfortable. Edie turns to me, has another outfit draped across her shoulders. I think it was the American flag. It says, how do I look in this outfit? Dismissing my concerns for my appearance in the film, and I therefore understood that it didn't hold any water. No, she didn't at all feel suspicious of me. She was working the camera so that she would be, it was just as empty a feeling for her to say, who's been moving books around here. At the time, immediately after first seeing that caption, I was hurt, but I addressed Edie right after the film, and she dismissed it as irrelevant and useless. It didn't mean anything, and indeed it didn't.
Hmm.
There was never any real animosity directed towards me while I was aware of it. And behind the camera, yes, Edie would say things, but that was easy, you know. She would say whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted, and I allowed her that liberty. I never took part in being heard by her. Mrs. Beale was always consistent with me and protected me and knew my soul and knew my person.
Hmm.
But Edie, she did run hot and cold, but she did that with many people.
Right.
And she was entitled to.
And that was just, that was
devoted to her mother.
Right. And that's who she was. That's what made her a unique, unforgettable character. And and that's part of what makes Grey Gardens such an interesting film. Well, there's, of course, much more to this story, and I wish we had more time to explore it. I really encourage people intrigued by what they've heard to pursue this book and read all of the remarkable stories that are part of it. The Marble Fawn of Grey Gardens, a memoir of the Beales, the Maysles brothers, and Jacqueline Kennedy. And the book is published by Corel Press. The co-authors, Jerry Torrey and Tony Maeda. Jerry Torrey, Tony Maeda, I've really enjoyed this, and I thank you for making time in your schedules for this conversation on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, one of our interviews will be a preview of the Racine Theatre Guild's newest production, which is Peter and the Starcatcher, which opens this weekend and runs the following weekend as well. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The morning show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back.